Welcome to our third presentation on mutual funds. In this presentation, we will take a look at the various types of mutual funds, starting from the most aggressive all the way to the least aggressive. The most riskiest, do you want to eat well? Down to the least riskiest, or do you want to sleep well? And folks, we are just going to scrape the surface. We're just going to look at the most wide, the widest categories, the broadest categories. There are subcategories and sub-subcategories and many others. But if you know these, you will be fairly able to figure out where the others fit in somewhere along this spectrum. And remember, you're going to be the expert, so you need to know these categories. And they're going to be on the test. Okay. Slide number 40. Are you on slide number 40? All right. What you're also going to need is the mutual fund scramble sheet. Okay? So make sure you have that either on your screen or you've printed it out, because it gives you an overview, a huge map, if you will, as we go through these. Because we're going to focus on each one at a time, but you need to also keep in the you need to keep in your mind the spectrum, the entire the entire roadmap, if you will, of all the different types of mutual funds. Okay? So have that at your disposal. Slide number 40. The most aggressive funds are called aggressive growth funds. Well, that makes a lot of sense, doesn't it? These are highly speculative mutual funds that seek large profits from capital gains. Yeah, they're out there trying to throw the Hail Mary pass or hit the home run ball, swing for the fences. I don't know if those analogies work well. They roll into dice, folks. And some fund categories, as we read at the bottom, now have a category, and some fund companies, excuse me, now have a category or two more speculative than aggressive growth. You'll sometimes see them called ultra funds or momentum funds. And we discussed in the previous, on the first presentation, Janus 20. Do you remember, we talked about that a mutual fund has to have at least 20 different securities because they can put no more than 5% of their assets into any one investment? Right. So these kind of companies are saying to you, we are going to try to make as much money as we can. But what do we know about the they're high risk. They're going to be extremely volatile, which is a euphemism for I lost a ton of money. And they're going to test your emotional stability as well as your intellectual prowess. The next group are growth funds. And these funds are, you know, all other things being equal, and they never are, less aggressive than their aggressive growth funds cousins. But still, the idea is capital gains. We're interested in long-term growth, maybe short-term growth, and these companies will typically invest in high-growth companies. Now, here's another analogy that you may like. If you don't, then forget about it. But I like, when I think of mutual funds, I like to think of a buffet, because I love food, right? And at the buffet, when you go up to the table or the counter, do you fill up your plate with the jalapeno peppers and the cayenne and all the really hot, spicy foods? No. Well, I guess a few people do, but you put a little bit of spice, right? A little bit of spice on your plate to liven up your dinner. And that's the way I think most people should approach these. Put a little bit of your money in your 401k or your Roth IRA or your regular account, whatever, into these aggressive growth funds or growth funds. Personally, I don't have any aggressive growth funds. Okay, so I don't really think they're the best things for individuals, but you know, they're up to you. All right, so that's the idea. Spice. Now, here's where we're going to get a little tricky. Already, right? Slide number 41. The next category is called capital appreciation. Capital appreciation funds seek long-term growth of capital. Wait a minute. Wait a minute. How is that different from the growth funds? Well, if you look at the scramble sheet, you see that I've tried to draw the words capital appreciation funds around the aggressive growth funds and the growth funds, because they are lumped in together. They are often talked about in the same conversation. The capital appreciation funds are often lumped together with growth funds and aggressive growth funds, but they're not the same. The difference is subtle. And read on slide number 41. Most growth funds have a provision in the prospectus that states that they will invest primarily in growth stocks. Now, what are growth stocks? We'll get to those when we get to chapter 5. They'll usually stay between 80 and 100% invested in the market. So they won't try to time the market. They're going to be interested in growth. Whereas capital appreciation funds can often invest in any type of company and anywhere that they like. And they don't have to always be totally invested. So they tend to be more flexible. Now, of course, each one is different, so that's what makes it even harder to follow. But in general, they tend to be as risky as growth and aggressive growth funds, but not always. And so a good analogy for these might be that they tend to paint with a broad brush, whereas the growth funds, the aggressive growth funds, are going to be invested in the growth companies of the day. The capital appreciation funds might look at a company that's not considered a growth fund and say, hey, we think there is an opportunity for growth of capital. We think there's an opportunity for appreciation of capital, which is a fancy way of saying the price is going to go up. That's what capital appreciation stands for. So you see what you're up against? Exactly. And you might have heard of Fidelity Magellan. That is a very famous fund. That was the fund run by none other than Peter Lynch, who wrote the book One Up on Wall Street, one of the books in your bibliography that you're going to read. In fact, probably the first book you're going to want to read. And it just turned out that having a capital appreciation fund under his command worked really, really well for Mr. Lynch, because he's the kind of investor that likes all different types of companies. Very eclectic is the word is. And the Fidelity Magellan Fund, being a capital appreciation fund, let him invest pretty much anywhere in any type of company that he was interested in. And it worked well. He racked up 29% a year for 12 years. Yeah. So capital appreciation often lumped together with aggressive growth and growth funds, but very subtle difference. Slide number 42. We now move down the risk versus reward spectrum and come to my favorite category, and that is growth and income. Growth and income. Well, growth from stocks. These are still stock funds, folks. These are still stock funds. And I hope you're looking at the scramble sheet, because I build the scramble sheet on the board, on the whiteboard in the face-to-face class, but we don't have that here, so have that at your disposal. Growth and income funds are stock funds that invest both for growth, that's capital appreciation, and income. Dividends, right? From stocks. The income is dividends. They may sometimes own bonds to augment the income, but usually not. They're usually going to be after dividends, and that means they have to buy stocks. Sometimes you'll hear people call them blend funds. Sometimes you'll hear people call them value funds. Okay. Now, value funds, though, when some people call the fund a value, is often a little different than growth and income. A value fund, again, everything being equal, and it never is a mutual fund that seeks stocks that are undervalued in the market by investing in shares that have low PE multiples and high dividend yields. What are you talking about? Relax. We'll discuss price to earnings ratio and dividend yields in detail when we get to chapter 5. But the idea of a value fund is that it's going to try to find companies that are out of favor, that are overlooked by the market. And the companies that people are poo-pooing, oh, they're old-fashioned fuddy-duddies. And the trick is that often these things are all lumped in together. But there are differences, subtle differences. And when you're studying this, you need to really, take a good look at the individual fund that you're interested in, as always. But where do we put this on our buffet, right? What do we say are our growth and income funds? Well, I like to think of these as the entree, the main dish, the pasta, the meat and potatoes, the lasagna. This is what you're going to have the most of on your plate. At least that's my humble opinion. Some people might disagree, but that's what I like to think of. We want growth. Yes, growth is good. But we also want income. We want dividends. Why? Because as we're going to see, dividends don't lie. Dividends are money in your pocket. And so when the market falls, those dividends have a tendency to buoy the stock, to hold the mutual fund. They tend to hold the floor underneath you. It doesn't fall. It doesn't disappear underneath your feet as it can with their aggressive growth funds or the growth funds. Make sense? Okay. So now we're trying to eat a little well, and we're trying to sleep a little well, too. And I like that. That's why I say this is my personal favorite. Slide number 43. Coming down to the bottom of the risk versus return category for stock mutual funds, this is still stock mutual funds, are equity income funds. Now, what a name, equity income. What does it mean? Well, equity means stock, income means dividend. So why don't they just call them stock dividend funds? Wrong. The industry's not that easy. And you're supposed to understand what equity income means, aren't you? Right. And these are mutual funds on slide 43 that emphasize current income and capital preservation by investing primarily in high-yielding, income-producing common stocks, such as railroads, food companies, utilities, real estate investment trusts. Now, are these the aggressive growth companies that you'll find in an aggressive growth mutual fund? No, you're not going to find a railroad. Been around for almost 200 years. You're not going to find these companies in an aggressive growth mutual fund. But you will find them in an equity income fund, in a stock dividend fund. Now remember, they are stocks still. They're mostly, they'll sometimes invest in bonds to generate income when the investment advisor believes that stock prices have risen to levels that threaten preservation of capital, which means they can hold bonds, and they will. But they're stock funds, so folks, they're going to go down when the stock market goes down. But if you look at history, when the market tanks, so to speak, when the market falls, as it invariably will do from time to time, the equity income funds will fall far less than their other stock fund cousins, than the aggressive growth funds, and even the growth and income funds. So in 2008, when the aggressive growth funds fell 60-70%, the growth and income funds fell 40-50%, the equity income funds fell 30-35%. Which, if you run the numbers, is a very big difference. Exactly. Now, when the market comes back, are the equity income funds going to explode on the upside? No, that's just not going to happen. So where do we put these in our buffet analogy? I like to think of them as the oatmeal. I know oatmeal's not exciting, but it's good for you. And it's not going to give you heartburn. And look what it does for horses. Yeah, I know. So, So if that makes any sense, great. And if it doesn't, just ignore it. Let's read the bottom of 43. Many equity income funds did very well during the 2000 to 2002 bear market. After lagging the market badly during the late 1990s internet and technology-driven bull market. So what happened? In the late 90s, the kinds of companies that an equity income fund had in their portfolio were considered old economy as opposed to the new economy, right? The internet, the software, the telecommunications companies. And if you were old enough to remember then, it wasn't that long ago, nobody wanted old economy companies. And yet these equity income funds were seeing incredible values in the investments that they were buying, many of which were going down. And so when the world changed, as it invariably does, they did really well in the 2000 to 2002 bear market. The S&P 500 went down 50%, almost, not quite, but almost 50%. Some of them went up, right, because the dividend-yielding companies that had been so out of favor in the 1990s all of a sudden looked really good. Now, did it help them in 2008? Yeah, relative to their cousins, but no, every type of mutual fund, especially stock mutual fund, was clobbered in 2008. Okay, so we've gone from the riskiest down to the least riskiest of the stock funds. Remember, these are still stock funds. They're still going to exhibit the kind of volatility that stocks exhibit. Now what we're going to do is we're going to add more layers of classifications. We're going to now say what size companies are you going to invest in, and where are they going to be invested. So the first category that we're going to add is called the capitalization, which is a fancy word of saying way of saying how big is the company. And there are three main categories: large cap, mid cap, small cap. And we're not talking about baseball caps. We're talking about how big the company is, that how big the companies are that the stock market, that the mutual fund invests in. And, of course, the largest companies are the ones that we've heard of. And we'll discuss this in detail when we get to Chapter 5, so my apologies again, but that's the problem with looking at mutual funds first. And the smallest companies are called small cap. And which do you think is the riskiest? Right, you're right. The riskiest companies are the smallest companies. Why? Because unlike their large company cousins, they don't have their roots deep in the economy, such as a GE or a Microsoft or a McDonald's or Coca-Cola. So when things go badly, the large cap companies tend to hold on because, you know, they're not going anywhere, and the small companies get clobbered. However, when things turn around, right, the small companies, first of all, they were hammered the hardest when things went badly, and they're more nimble. They're more able to take advantage of new opportunities. So the small company's stocks will rally, and of course the small company stock mutual funds that invest in those small companies will do better. And of course, mid-cap companies or somewhere in between. All right, the next category is called domesticity, and we've discussed this already. Do you remember the subtle difference between global and international? Right, you need to know this, folks. Don't get it wrong on the exam. Domestic mutual funds invest in companies based in the U.S. Global invest everywhere, including the United States, todo el mundo, all the world, and international invest in companies outside the United States. Now, 50 years ago, it used to be very clear-cut. Domestic was the least riskiest, international was the riskiest, and global was in between, because you added United States to everybody outside the world. But that's not true anymore, folks. In fact, domesticity is a very, very illusionary. Is that a word? elusive characteristic. Why? Because some companies based in the United States do far more business outside the United States. And some companies based outside the United States do a lot of their business, if not most of their business, inside the United States. And there are some companies based in the United States that don't do any business in the United States. They do it all outside the United States. So, right, it goes back to what we said back in Chapter 1. The world is global, and get used to it. So this categorization, this characteristic is not as important as it used to be. It's still something you need to take into account. But you understand. So what happens now? What happens? Well, what happens is we find that the mutual fund companies, in an effort to innovate and compete with their competitors, will say, we just came up with a global large cap growth fund. So pick one from column A and one from column B and one from column C. And or they say, it's a domestic small cap aggressive growth fund. And of course, if one company does it, then they all have to do it. So you see the different permutations and combinations that can be created. Yeah, take nine things, two at a three at a time. I don't remember exactly how to say it, but it's statistics. And the explosion of mutual funds that we saw in the 1990s. Was because of this. They were all competing and they were all trying to fill up all the different slots for their customers, and that's how we wound up with 10,000 different mutual funds. Great. Now, further balkanization, which is a fancy way of saying breaking things up, occurred when mutual fund companies would offer regional funds that just invested in a certain company such as Japan or Canada, certain countries such as Japan or Canada, or an area of the world, the Far East, Latin America, Eastern Europe. Yeah, you can buy a mutual fund that just invests in Eastern Europe. Pretty amazing. And then the emerging markets started to take off. India, Mexico, Brazil, Russia, the Philippines. So you can invest in mutual funds that just invest in the emerging markets as a whole or in individual emerging markets. Now, wait a minute. What do you think about that? I mean, what were the two main reasons why we invested in a mutual fund? Do you remember? Right. For diversification and professional money management. So if you're now buying mutual funds that concentrate in certain areas of the world, does that make sense? In my mind, no. I like to have a global perspective. But others, no. You know, I worked in the Far East for 6 years, and oh boy, that place is booming. So I want to have a mutual fund that invests in the Far East. Fine. But again, don't load up your plate with it. Don't put the entire portfolio, your 401k or whatever, don't just invest in a mutual fund that invests in Mexico or China, because it's the wrong way. In my humble opinion, remember, everybody's different. Some people like chocolate, some people like vanilla, and others like strawberry. And Continuing that vein, many mutual fund companies created what are called sector funds. Sector funds are mutual funds that just invest in a sector of the economy. Energy, maybe just the companies that make the drilling equipment for the energy companies, you know, the exploration. Technology, and there are several subcategories under technology. Wireless communication, software, hardware, healthcare, and again there's pharmaceuticals and hospitals and different sectors of the economy. No, I disagree. I don't think it's a good idea, personally. If you know something about that industry because you've worked in it or you know people who work in it, then okay, you think it's a good idea, put 10% or 20%, but not your whole thing. And then if anybody tries to tell you that they know how to time the markets, you just go, you don't believe them because it's dumb. As we'll see, maybe you'll find out on your own, you got to be right twice. You got to know when to sell, you got to know when to buy. You got to know when to buy, you got to know when to sell. It's something that can't be done. In fact, there's a great quote from a very famous investor. We'll come back to it. Don't try to time the market. It can only be done by liars. People lie to everybody else, and they lie to themselves, too. Okay, let's continue. Now we're ready to go over to the other side of the investment universe, and that is bonds, right? We're going to sleep much better when we invest in bonds. So on the other side of our scramble sheet, you'll see the bond world. And again, we're going to go from the riskiest in the bond world, which is still a lot much less riskier than the stock world, down to the least riskiest bonds. So starting on slide 45, bonds, fixed income funds, bond funds are mutual funds that invest in various kinds and grades, meaning how good a loan is it? What are the prospects of getting your money back? With the primary objective as income. Normally, the primary objective will be for income, because that's what you get from bonds. Over the long sweep of time, you get interest. High yield bond funds. What's this, junk? Junk bond funds? Yeah, well, this is a bit of an exception when it comes to the bond world. Because these are loans, these are bonds, these are investments that are in distress, that are in danger of not actually paying their debt. Or they're just companies that, just because of their size or their reputation, don't get a very good rating, don't have a very good grade attached to them. Just as individuals have credit scores, bond issuers get ratings. And we'll discuss these in detail later on when we get to bonds. So what happens with these high-yield bond funds is they often are more correlated with stocks than they are with bonds. They tend to follow the stock market more than they tend to follow the bond market. So these are a bit of an anomaly. And these are for people who are more risk-oriented with regard to their bond investments. The next category is where we really move into the bond world in total, and those are corporate bond funds. These are generally very high-quality companies. They're going to pay their debt. We'll discuss the ratings in detail when we get the bonds, but these have high credit scores, so to speak. You might see a convertible bond fund. These are parts of the hybrid world that we'll discuss later on. There's not that many of them out there, so don't worry about it. But corporate bond funds are bond funds that invest mostly in companies, high ratings. You're not going to lose your money. I mean, a little time. Every once in a while, bond funds go down. We'll discuss why later on, but not like stocks. Now we move at the bottom of slide 45 into the municipal world. These are the states and the local governments and the local government agencies. So the city of Chula Vista, Sweetwater Authority, the Sweetwater Water District, the Southwestern Community College, or the state of California, or any municipality around the country. Some of them are insured by an insurance company that says, look, if this municipality goes under, we'll pay. Okay, that's pretty good. It turns out that these are popular with high net worth individuals. And why is that? Well, because in most all cases, your interest income is free from federal taxes. Very cool, right? That's pretty darn nice, isn't it? Yeah, it is. It's pretty good. And it turns out that it's very good for people in the upper income brackets. You know, so that's why these, well, you say high net worth individuals. if you buy a municipal bond fund in your state, for us, California, not only do you not pay federal income taxes, you also do not pay the state income taxes. Why? Because the state's trying to encourage people to buy their bonds. It doesn't have to be the state of California bonds. It could be Chula Vista bonds, San Diego bonds, or anywhere in the state. And you don't have to pay your federal income taxes, nor do you have to pay your state income taxes. Make sense? Yeah. Now, the next category are U.S. backed bonds on slide 46. These are bonds that are not specifically backed by the U.S. government. At least that's what they told everybody for decades. Entities such as Fannie Mae, and no, Fannie Mae is not a candy company. It's a mortgage. They package mortgages into big bundles and sell them all around the world. So they call it the secondary market. You're not going to get your mortgage from Fannie Mae. You're going to get it from a credit union or a bank. But they're going to just who's hiding behind the bank is Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac. And for decades, these things, even though they were sponsored by the United States Congress, the politicians said, no, we're not backing these things until the organic matter hit the ventilating device and the real estate bubble burst. And now you are a proud co-owner, dear taxpayer, United States taxpayer, of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. And what are we going to do with these things? There's always talk about how we're going to deal with them, but they're still out there, folks. Sometimes called mortgage-backed bond funds. We'll discuss these in detail when we get to bonds. Yeah, so that remember the politicians jumping up and down saying, we're not going to back these things, we're not going to, oh yes we are, when things go, because they don't want the whole world to fall apart. Okay, now, the last category when it comes to risk would be government bond funds. These are treasury bonds, government securities. They are explicitly backed by the full faith and credit of the United States Treasury. And one of the interesting things about these is that they are free from state income tax. What's going on? Municipal bond funds are free from federal income taxes, and treasury bonds are free from state income taxes. Yeah, it's part of the Constitution. The Constitution of the United States government says that the feds can't tax the states, and the states can't tax the feds. So if you buy a municipal bond, you don't pay federal income tax. If you buy a treasury bond, you don't pay state income tax. Very interesting. Okay, so that was from the riskiest bond funds down to the least riskiest. And now, just as we did with stocks, we're going to overlay two other categories on top of them. We're going to overlay when the bonds mature. Are they long-term bond funds, intermediate-term, or short-term? Now, careful. Long-term starts with L, so does large cap. Short-term starts with S, so does small cap. And intermediate is kind of like mid-cap. No, they have nothing to do with one another. Don't confuse this category, with the capitalization of the stock funds. Long-term bond funds are the riskiest, and short-term are the least riskiest. Now, when you think about it, it sure makes sense. If you're going to lend your money out for 30 years, as opposed to 2 years, Isn't there a greater opportunity for something to go wrong in those intervening 30 years as opposed to the intervening 2 years? Exactly. A fundamental part of finance states that the longer you have the money lent out to whoever you lend it to whomever you lend it to, there's more chances for things to go wrong. So the long-term bond funds turn out to be the riskiest, the short-term, the least riskiest. And then we'll overlay on top of that, whether it's domestic or global or international. And you remember the distinction between those three, right? Right? Domestic, inside the United States, global, all over the world, international, outside the United States. And just as we did in the stock world, we're going to create one from column A, one from column B, one from column C. And this is a domestic, long-term, high-yield bond fund. And wind up with 10,000 different mutual funds. Good. Okay, so now you're going to study those, right? Well, you're not done yet. Let's keep going. Slide number 47, balance funds. Balance funds. This is interesting. These are mutual funds whose objective is to generate a balanced return of both current income and long-term capital gains. They invest in both stocks and bonds. And normally, it'll be about 60% stocks, 40% bonds. Why? We'll discuss that later on in the semester, sometimes 50-50. But the allocation can change as the investment environment changes. Now, Piano, you told us that we're going to go from the most riskiest to the least riskiest, and yet you're putting the balance funds after the bond funds. That doesn't make sense to me. If you take something that's fairly risky, stocks, and something that's much less risky, bonds, and you put them together, wouldn't you get something in between? Well, it turns out, dear students, that no, you wind up with something that exhibits less risk than either the two together. That's counterintuitive. Well, there's a reason for this that we'll discuss later on, but real quickly, in practice, it's not a guarantee. When bonds go down, stocks go up. And when stocks go down, bonds go up. They are negatively correlated. Now, not always. 2008, right, everybody fell down. But it turns out when you mix the two in a balance, you get something that exhibits less risk as measured by standard deviation, which we've already discussed back in Chapter 1, is an imperfect measure at best. Yeah. And balance funds are great choices for people in their 401k plans or whatever who are really worried about sleeping well. But they still want to eat well. You get a little bit the best of both worlds in that respect. Right. You won't eat as well as if you just go with stock funds, but you're going to sleep actually a little bit better than just going with a bond fund. Very interesting. Great choice, I believe, for many people. Here's an example of a balanced fund that's been around, I don't know, since 1937 or something like that. The prospectus of the American Balanced Fund states that the fund is managed as the complete U.S. investment program of a prudent investor. Prudent, you know what that means, right? You know, I want to invest, but I don't want to, you know, roll the dice. And in their prospectus, they will tell you that, look, we will never be more than 75%, 25%. 75% stocks, 25% bonds. We'll never go more than that in terms of the stock world. And we will never have less than 50% stocks, 50% bonds. So they will keep a balance. Make sense? Good. Know this one, folks. This is an important one. Even if you feel very, very comfortable going with stock funds, you're going to be the expert, and you want to be able to explain to your friends who are terrified that this is a good choice for the long term. Slide number 48. Uh-oh. Nothing's ever that easy, is it? The other category that is often lumped in with balanced funds is called asset allocation. Well, already, it sounds more sophisticated, doesn't it? Yeah, too sophisticated for its own good, in my humble opinion. These are mutual funds that spread investors' money across stocks, bonds, and money market securities. Remember, short-term investments, cash. They are very similar to balance funds. In fact, they are usually lumped together, but there's a subtle distinction which can create a bad or maybe a very good result compared to their balance fund cousins. With asset allocation funds, the investment advisor often more diligently tries to fine-tune the allocation as market conditions change. Whereas we saw with a balance fund, they'll stay, 60-40, 50-50, 75-25, never more than 75-25, never less than 50-50, around 60-40. An asset allocation fund might try to move all your money into cash when they thought the market might fall, or move everything into bonds, or move everything into stocks. Exactly. That's market timing, folks. It's market timing, and it's not something that can be done by we humans. For all their hype, the returns of many asset allocation funds are similar to balance funds, but some trail balance funds considerably because they timed the market badly. So all their things being equal, and dear students, they never are, in my humble opinion, you're better off with a balance fund than you are with an asset allocation fund. But you have to do your research about the individual funds that you are considering. Slide number 49. The very last category in terms of risk versus return are money market. Money market mutual funds, but most people just call them money markets. If you remember from chapter 1, these are mutual funds that invest in short-term money market instruments. They're much the same as their money market counterparts at banks and credit unions, except money market mutual funds are not guaranteed by any government or federal agency until the organic matter hits the ventilating device, and then the white knight runs in and says, don't worry, we won't let these things go down. There are general purpose money market mutual funds that invest in treasury bills, commercial paper. There are government securities mutual funds, money market mutual funds that just invest in treasury bills. That's how safe these people want. And then there are tax-exempt money market. How do they do that? Well, what they do, folks, is they buy these municipal bonds, but that are going to mature in 6 months or 3 months. So they wind up looking like commercial paper or a treasury bill. They are essentially as safe as guaranteed money market accounts at banks, since they invest in exactly the same securities, but they are not specifically guaranteed. I think we mentioned that. Yeah, we did mention that already. And if this piques your interest, what you want to do is you want to look up, just type in to any search engine, breaking the buck. That's exactly what they do. They go from a dollar down to 99 cents. And the whole world stands up and takes notice. And if, as we said this in chapter one, if there's a problem, the company goes to the federal regulators and says, we got a problem. Will you let us take money out of our pocket and put it into our investors' pockets? And the feds say, yeah, you do that. And if they can't do it, somebody will do it for them. And if it looks like everybody can't do it, then the Federal Reserve Bank steps in. And yeah, so we don't want people to think that these things are going to go down. Now, there's was a movement. I don't know. We'll see. They're going to revisit it. But there's talk about changing the whole way that these things work. And it's one of those situations where you might wind up throwing the baby out with the bathwater. We'll see how it works, okay? We'll see how it goes through. But the idea is, hey, we're going to allow these things to float so that you're not guaranteed. You're not guaranteed anyway, but basically you are. You might lose money, but now they say you might lose money, but you won't because they won't let you lose money. So if it sounds confusing, you're right, it is, and there's some controversy. But I don't think things are going to change anytime soon. Slide number 50. Well, look, you knew it had to happen, right? What? Mutual funds of mutual funds? Right. You're kidding, right? No, you're not. We're not kidding. These are very popular. And why is that? Because of 401k plans. What's going on here? These are mutual funds that invest in other mutual funds, usually of the same company. If Fidelity offers, they put Fidelity mutual funds in there. Vanguard offers them, they put Vanguard mutual funds in there. Part of your assignment is to look at the Thrift Savings Plan, which is the 401k plan for the federal government employees, and they have these lifestyle funds. And I want you to look at them because they're pretty interesting. What you do is you say, okay, I am going to retire in 2035 or 2055, or my child is going to go to school in 2020 or 2025. You purchase, invest in that mutual fund with that date, and they will populate the mutual funds with other mutual funds to match the time horizon. And as I said, usually with the same company's mutual fund choices. And as the time horizon shortens, the mutual fund will change the mix of mutual funds for you. So if you're not retiring for another 40 years, and some of you millennials, that's what's going to happen, they will mostly have stock funds. And as you get closer and closer to 2055 or whatever date you're going to retire, they will move down the risk versus return reward spectrum, risk versus reward spectrum for you. They will fine-tune the allocation for you. Make sense? Yeah, it does make sense. And because of the laws regarding 401k plans, these things are very popular. Why is that? Well, because if you start working for a certain company, they are allowed, given your birthday, you know, and when your expected date of retirement is, they're allowed to automatically enroll you into their 401k plan, as long as they pick the appropriate target date fund, the appropriate lifestyle fund, whatever you want to call it. Whoever, my like Fidelity calls it the Freedom Fund, like you're based in Boston, you know, riffing on that Freedom and 1776 kind of deal. And so, as long as they do that, they are cool. You can't sue them for bad recommendations regarding investments. So that's why these things are very, very popular. So you'll see them. You'll see them when you take a look at the various options that the mutual fund companies offer in the face-to-face class. Of course, I would show these to everybody, but you're going to be looking. You're in online. You're going to look for them yourself. And you can't find them, contact me, because you're going to. But you need to find them for the thrift savings plan as part of your assignment. Slide number 51. Now, specialty funds. Oh, dear students, stay far away from these things. I mean, the choices are endless. It's just so hard to believe that the industry has exploded in this way, but it has. The first category on slide 51 are specialty funds. I'm sorry, of our slide 51 specialty funds is hedge funds. These literally are not mutual funds. They do not come under the Investment Company Act of 1940, and they were traditionally only open to sophisticated investors, which meant you had to have an income of $200,000 or $1 million of net worth. But not anymore. Now people with $10,000 can invest in them, and they have sky high fees. They can do whatever they want. If they want to put all their money in one stock, they're allowed to do that. Stay away from them. They are for they're supposed to be for people who could lose $100,000 and still be happy, can still sleep at night. That's not you, nor is it me. So stay away. Bear funds try to make money when the market goes down. Ain't easy, folks, because the market, over the long sweep of history, goes up every 3 years. For every 1 year it goes down, so it's not easy to do. It can be done, but I stay away from it. You can buy mutual funds that invest in gold and other precious metals and hard assets, commodities. Wait till we talk about futures, folks, and wait till we talk about gold. Real estate investment funds, well, now these aren't that bad because it's a way to invest in real estate without having to be a landlord. The problem with REIT funds is there's just not that many REITs. There's not that many real estate investment trusts out there. So it basically is a sector fund, and it some of them do well. Don't get me wrong, but don't bet the farm. Don't put all your money into these things. Of all the mutual funds on this page, on this slide, REIT funds are probably the least dangerous. And then there are just hundreds of these boutique exotic funds, which are some of which are just downright silly. How about the stock car stocks funds? What do you think they invest in? NASCAR. Yeah. It's hard to believe, but the nation's most popular spectator sport is not football or baseball. It's NASCAR. And these people are very serious about their NASCAR. If Nextel, or I doubt if it's still, because they no longer operate in the United States, but for a while their Nextel was the official cell phone of NASCAR, and that's what they all had. They all had Nextels. Something to be said for that. How about the Paws Tombstone Fund? Paws is the name of the company. Tombstone was the name of the fund. Right. They invested in mortuaries and cemeteries because everybody got to die someday, and thankfully so did the Paws Tombstone Fund. And then I am not making this up. You can't make this up. There was a fund called the Chicken Little Growth Fund for people who were worried that the sky was falling. Don't believe me. Go look it up. Don't believe me. It's unbelievable. It's incredible what we have wrought, what we have created. And I don't think it lasted very long. I'm pretty sure it didn't last very long. There are funds just for Christians. There's the Timothy Fund, something about the letter from St. Paul to Timothy. And Muslims, there's funds for Muslims because they can't make loans, but there's a way they can make loans that they're really not making loans, but they are. And so look them up if you're so inclined. The choices are endless, and by the way, so are the fees. Slide number 52, index funds. Okay, look, we need to spend a little bit of time discussing index funds. Very important, very important. Why? Because these things are exploding, as we said. Another term for that is passively managed. These are mutual funds that buy and hold a portfolio of stocks or bonds equivalent to those in a specific market index. As we said, there is no active management. So remember those terms, passive management, index funds, active management. The companies are going out there and trying to buy and sell the stocks that they think are going to do well, or bonds. Why are they popular? Well, as we saw, they can offer much lower annual fees. Right? They don't do any research. Be careful. Some of them do have high annual fees. Why? Because they can, and they stuff it inside your 401k and hope that you don't understand how you're being screwed. Because of the annual fee, an index fund cannot actually match the market's performance. But it should come very close, right? It should come close, providing the annual fee is not excessive. Whereas, as we saw in the previous presentation, an actively managed fund could substantially outperform or substantially underperform the market index. So, where's the rationale coming from? Well, back in the late 60s, early 1970s, there was research that showed that many of the actively managed funds did not beat the market. They said, you can't do as well as a monkey throwing darts at a dartboard and just randomly choosing stocks. And it was true. Many actively managed funds did not beat the market. Well, we said, look, you've got to do as well as your annual operating expenses just to match the market. Because you've already got one hand tied behind your back. However, we see over time that many actively managed funds do beat their respective indexes over significant periods, not periods of time, not just 1 or 3 years, but 10 years, 20 years, or more. And what my opinion and my advice is to look for a fund family, and we'll discuss families in the next presentation, where most all the funds have consistently beaten their indexes over decades. And there's only a few major companies. And of course, any time you find an investment idea that becomes the the only way, the best way, the surefire, fail-safe, superlative way, you know it ain't going to last. They're going to become victims of their own success, and that's what has happened in some cases with index funds. Here are some of the indices that are very popular. Slide 54, Standard & Poor's 500. Well, we already saw, right? That's the most popular one. The Dow Jones Industrial Average, what is that? We'll discuss that in detail next chapter, but that's probably not a very good one, in my humble opinion. The Dow Jones U.S. Total Stock Market Index. What a dumb name. It used to be called the Wilshire 5000. Then it was called the Dow Jones Wilshire 5000, and then Dow Jones. They're the people who published the Wall Street Journal, by the way. They kicked Wilshire out, and now they call it the Dow Jones U.S. Total Stock Market Index, or just the Total Stock Market Index. Now, this is the one. If people are definitely keen on index funds, I say I like this one the best because it includes not only the large cap, which are in the Standard & Poor's 500, but also the mid cap and small cap. So that's my favorite, but I don't invest with index funds. So I'm just telling you my bias is right up ahead. The NASDAQ is the technology world. We'll discuss that in detail in Chapter 5. The MSCI Global, the World Fund, the MSCI International, the Index Fund, IFA. We'll discuss those in Chapter 5. So relax. Don't worry. You don't have to know these. Just recognize them. You don't have to come up with them. Countless other next chapter you will. Chapter 5 you will. Countless other index funds are available. Index funds are now the perfect investment. You talk to some people who say, oh, you should only go with index funds. In fact, here's the index fund advisor. Listen to us. We'll tell you how. What, if any, are downsides to index funds? Well, let me show you here, folks. Indexes sometimes become skewed toward a particular sector of the economy or region of the world. Now, you're not going to understand slide 55 now, but after we're going to go back to this after we finish stocks and bonds, and you're going to have a better understanding of what I'm talking about. In 1989, many of you weren't even born yet, but I'm old enough to remember in the 1980s when Japan was going to take over the world. The Japanese stock market skyrocketed. Their real estate market was untouchable. People were buying houses with 100-year loans. And you thought you were buying a broad-based index by buying the MSCI IFA. That's a silly term for the international market. Includes everybody except the United States, so Europe, Australia, and the Far East. That's what IFA stands for. But what you were buying, folks, was 60% Japan and 40% everybody else. So 40% all of Europe, Hong Kong, Singapore, and the Australia. That was mostly what was the market at the time. So you thought you were getting a broad-based index, but you weren't. You were getting 60% Japan with a PE of almost 52. Now, you don't understand PE, but you will, and that's really high. Everybody else's PE was 13, but much more reasonable PE, as we'll see. What happened? Over the next 10 years, the Japanese stock market fell from about 38,000 down to 8. Yeah, so you thought you were broad-based and you were getting a smattering of everybody outside the United States, but you weren't. And the same thing happened to the Standard & Poor's 500. Standard & Poor's 500 at the end of 1990s into March of 2000 when it hit its peak was fully 33% technology, internet-related, computers, software, telecommunications, whereas two-thirds of it, 66%, was everything else. And everything else means healthcare and materials and railroads and energy, old economy stocks. The PE of the information technology sector was almost 60, 59.2, very high. And everybody else had 19.3, which was still pretty high. That's pretty high by, historical standards. And we'll discuss why later on when we get to Chapter 5 in PE. But if you had said to people, oh, I'm buying the Standard & Poor's 500. I'm getting a broad-based index of the 500 largest companies in the United States. But what you were buying was one-third companies that were really, really expensive. And the S&P 500 went on to lose 50% between March of 2000 down to October of 2002, but the NASDAQ, which is mostly all technology companies, the technology companies went down 80%. The internet companies went down 97%. Most of which disappeared. A few of them are still around, eBay. But no, most of them just disappeared. So you see, you have to be careful. There is no such thing as a no-risk, fail-safe investment. Every investment has advantages, every investment has disadvantages. Okay, off my soapbox. And you'll understand this later. We're going to come back to this. Don't worry. If you don't understand everything I talked about this slide, don't worry, because we're going to come back to it. We're going to discuss this after we've gone through stocks and bonds in detail. Slide number 56, ETFs. Well, we've already made reference to these ETFs, right? You remember these? The exchange-traded funds. They're open-end mutual funds that trade like a stock, as any listed security, on a stock exchange. So they have one foot in the one world, they're an open-end fund, and they have another foot in the other world. They're like a closed-end fund in that they bought and sold on the open market. But they're like an open-end fund because there's no limit to the number of shares. They are becoming very popular. Many people are using them as trading vehicles, day trading vehicles. They can be bought and sold throughout the day, like stocks, where you can't do that with an open-end mutual fund. You need to buy it once a day, and the mutual fund company wants you to hang on to it, whereas the ETF doesn't care because they don't even know who owns it. It's up to the brokerage firms to keep track of that. Most all of the ETFs currently are passively managed index funds, but there are some actively managed. Now, if they're actively managed, what's going to happen to the fees is going to go up because it costs a lot of money to manage a mutual fund if you're trying to go out there and do it right. So, but most of them are passively managed index funds with very, very low fees. And the best thing about ETFs is they have very cool names like Spider and Diamond and Cube. Spider is the S&P 500, Diamond is the Dow Jones. Anyway, and we'll discuss these again later on, but they're becoming very, very popular. Slide 57. Socially responsible. Relax, folks. We're almost done. I know it's been a while. Relax. Socially responsible funds. These are mutual funds that actively and directly incorporate ethics and morality into the investment decisions. Huh? Yeah. It started out with some funds many, many years ago, before the term socially responsible even came into being, refusing to invest in companies that sold alcohol or tobacco. Well, because there are many people who have strong feelings against alcohol, especially tobacco. And then it moved to companies that pollute, build weapons, nuclear power plants, destroy the rainforest, forest, etc., and then companies to exploit labor. It's surprising that there are any companies left to invest in. And silliness aside, folks, many of these socially responsible funds have done quite well for their investors. Why? Because over the last 30-some-odd years, they've invested mostly in newer technology companies, which don't do any of these things. Some of them might say, what are you talking about? We're exploiting. We work 60 hours a week. Yeah, but we're excited because we're creating this new technology. And then slide 58, socially responsible funds. What? Possibly as a backlash to socially responsible funds and their perceived political overtones, politically correct, there is a mutual fund called the Vice Fund. I love it, right? The Vice Fund. Yeah, you guessed it. It invests in tobacco and alcohol. The manager says he simply loves Philip Morris. And all the other corporate nasties that you can think of, gambling and defense firms. And although it is still a very small fund with high annual fees, it's actually done very well for its investors. So check out the Vice Fund, dear students. Slide number 58. What is that? Well, that's out of the Wall Street Journal. And that's just, again, another smattering of all the different types of funds out there. And I think it's actually a few years old. Check it out. It's from your book. That's where I got it from. But, and of course, if you're looking at this on a small screen, you can't read any of this, but that's what you're up against, folks. But I am going to hold you to the categories that are in this presentation. Is that a deal? All right? You don't have to learn all these different types of funds, but make sure you understand the funds that are on that in the presentation and on the scramble sheet. All right, last slide, and then we're done for today. I know it's been a slog, and you're going to go back and do it again, right? We get to a company called Morningstar. Now, for many years, there was a company, it's still around, called Lipper, and they would do their analysis. It was a rating agency and a company, research agency, that would discuss mutual funds. But Lipper is considered old-fashioned, kind of fuddy-duddy, and Morningstar comes along and says, we're going to jazz things up. We're going to make it easier for people to understand mutual funds, and they've been successful, very successful. And they created what they called their style boxes to help investors identify investment alternatives. And they say they're fabulous, but I have great issue with these because they sort of encourage or condone the idea of breaking up mutual funds into these little pieces. Do you have a large, small, or medium, small? Do you have a value, blend, growth, or whatever these style boxes are supposed to mean? And then so that means you have to have 9 different mutual funds, one to fit each ever. I don't like it, personally. They have sort of acknowledged that it wasn't the best idea because now they have what are called ownership zones where kind of looks like this style box, but instead of a little rectangle, they use an oval. No one I know uses them, neither do I, and so I'll leave it at that. But that doesn't mean you shouldn't go to Morningstar.com. If you do do some of your research, be careful because they're going to try to sign you up for $20 a month or $50 a month. So what are you going to do? You're going to go back over this, make sure you understand the major categories as described in the presentation and on the scramble sheet, realizing that these are just the major categories. There are many, 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 many subcategories and sub-sub-subcategories and sub-sub-sub-sub-subcategories. Whew! Okay. In our next and last presentation on mutual funds, we will discuss mutual fund families and a few other odds and ends, and then take a look at a single mutual fund, just one, and try to extrapolate that into the world as a whole. See you in our next and final presentation on mutual funds.